his PhD at the University of Maryland. Now, he started off doing a PhD in economics, and at that time, he also started taking some mathematics courses because he was into mathematics and also wanted to get a degree in that. Well, he finished his economics degree and got a position as an associate professor at the University of Maryland, and with the understanding that he finished his mathematics PhD in the succeeding years, which he did. So he has both degrees. He's, the author of many papers, but he is also the president-elect of the Bachelier Finance Society, and he's not going to tell us anything about that today, but he is going to tell us about some, modeling using linear processes in mathematical finance, specifically in derivative pricing.
Thanks. So, this is a talk on, as Ulrich was saying, on Levy processes in financial modeling, and primarily, is this is the focus okay? That's a little better. Yeah. And primarily, has been in modeling equity to sort of understanding and calibration with data on. But of course, the structures one develops would be of use in financial markets quite broadly and quite generally. And the paper here is a joint work with Carr, Elliot Gemman, and Mark Yore. And the talk, of course, will go a little bit broader than the paper and put it in the context of how we're looking at these markets and how we're looking for these markets. This will be introducing you to what we've begun to call this class of processes, finite variation processes with infinite monotone activity. They differ in respects that I'll point out from the diffusion-based models that have been quite popular. And in presenting the case for these processes, I'll provide you first with some motivation for why these such processes are important and why we should be looking at them. And the motivation that I'll present will be empirical to begin with, present some statistical evidence that is in support of these type of structures. I've been persuaded for a long time that statistics doesn't persuade anyone all by itself. Basically, there must be some theoretical understanding behind it as well, and I'll present you with theoretical structures that argue in support of such models as well. Then we also want to learn from these markets as to how the markets price exposure to financial market uncertainty. And you'll see that there is, in financial analysis, two probability measures that we work with all the time. One probability measure tells you the relative frequency with which an event occurs. The other probability measure tells you the market price today of a dollar that's paid out if the event occurs. So all events have probabilities and market prices. And we need to learn how to switch measure from the frequency measure to the pricing measure. And basically, that's one of the more important activities in analyzing how markets price exposure is to learn the structure of this measure change. And in doing so, we'll see that the concepts of risk that we want to work with in understanding these measure changes go beyond what you get in diffusion models, which is just basically the entire uncertainty is characterized by the local volatility coefficient. But more generally, one has a whole lot of other moment structures that you need to be concerned about, namely in markets we know that there is substantial skewness in the pricing measure, which is not there in the statistical measure. And so we want to understand both of these measures and how one goes from one to the other, and one wants to understand the dimensions of these measures that go beyond just the volatility. And then I'll point out the questions that we're going to ask of the data in both the time series statistical context and the risk neutral context and see how we go about answering these questions. So let me begin with just some stylized empirical observations pointing in this type of direction of investigation. The first observation that I'd like to draw your attention to is work from time series data, which has been analyzed for many years and goes back to the 1960s, work by Farmer, that basically argued for and showed that daily returns are long-tailed relative to the normal density, and basically as you increase the time horizon, there is an approach to normality, but the short motion, the motion over small intervals, is definitely not Gaussian, but has much substantially higher levels of kurtosis than the one that you get with the normal of 3. And today, of course, we have data at much finer time frequencies, and you can go down to 1 minute, 15 minutes, gnarly return data, and observe similar things. And when you look at a simple table of such return data, you see quite clearly that the kurtosis levels are quite substantial relative to the Gaussian levels of 3, and basically you reject normality in the time series at very high levels of significance. Now, as I said, we're interested not only in the time series data and what returns are actually doing, but we're also interested in the pricing measure of how markets price this return structure. And one place where we get information on the pricing of risks, of course, is in the market for options. And if the local volatility structure was, if the model or if the local motion was Gaussian, then at short maturity, the option prices, when you price them using a log normal or Gaussian model, you should basically see a flat implied volatility, because basically you're saying that the model is Gaussian, and therefore you just work out its volatility and it'll price it, and you would see a flat implied volatility curve. Here's, we know from options data that the implied volatility curves are not flat at all, and let me just show you a graph of, this is the implied volatility curve on the S&P 500 for December 13th, 2000, so just end of last year. Now, of course, many academic studies that study this kind of data are basically, the spot is around 1360, and they're basically looking at between 1200 and 1400 in a small range, okay? Typically, of course, when you come into the industry and you've got to mark books of a firm, we deal with much wider ranges of strikes. We have strikes that go all the way from 800 almost to up to 2,000. And in that wide strike range, you see that the implied vol curves are going from almost 16 to 32. There's almost a doubling factor. And so the absence of local normality, and this is at 3 months. I mean, the situation is much steeper when you come down to 1 month or when you come down to 3 weeks. And, of course, we are marking books and valuing exposures, you know, all the way at all maturities, including the shortest one. So we are interested in model structures that will basically calibrate the option surface for all strikes and all maturities simultaneously with one model. And basically with this kind of evidence, one can see that Gaussian-based models are going to have a very hard time at it. You can also look at the analysis of extremes, whereby one looks at the distribution of the limiting distribution of the maxima or minima of independently sampled observations. And you have a central limit type theorem that says that the limiting distribution of maximas or minima is either Gumbel, Weibull, or Fréchet. And if you were sampling from log normal, then that log normal lies in the domain of attraction of the Gumbel, and so you should be observing the distribution of the maximum to be Gumbel. And if you're sampling from, say, log gamma, or which is one of the models we use, a Levy structure, then the domain of attraction is the Weibull or Fréchet, and so the limit should be there. And so what we did was took just 100 years of data on the Dow Jones Industrial Average and computed returns, and over 100 years of daily data, you have plenty of observations to start taking non-overlapping maxima. So we took 100-day intervals and took maxima over 100 non-overlapping 100-day intervals, and then just did a histogram and did a likelihood ratio test of what distribution, the limiting distribution of maxima and minima is. And so you look at that kind of analysis, and you can do a likelihood ratio test. And again, you reject the limiting distribution being Gumbel in favor of Weibull and Frechet, Weibull for the minimum, Frechet for the maximum. And so, again, taking another cut at the data, looking at it another way, you see evidence that you want to be looking at structures that are locally not Gaussian. Finally, I'll mention a property about basically just a slight look at the histogram. And if you take, we took this 100-year daily
route. Can I ask a question on the last slide?
Yeah, sure.
You probably know the long game study, right?
Yes. Yeah, he was looking at similar structures, yeah.
There's a difference between the distribution of the maximum worst outcome, which is what these things get theoretically, and the distribution of the tail. Are you going to talk more about that? Are you going to talk about the difference between the distribution of the extreme event and the distribution of the actual tail part of the curve?
No, I haven't looked at. I know that people look at modeling with QQ plots the rate at which the tail is decaying. Yeah, I haven't quite looked at that here.
See, one thing I've been interested in for years is to take the left tail and put something on that's more appropriate. In other words, paste on another distribution. But I think that the Frechet is not the proper choice because we're not quite.
Okay. Right. Yeah, okay, right. And then, of course, my interest, of course, is also not just in having a distribution for the return. I want the whole stochastic process for the whole option pricing structure. Finally, I'll be motivating and talking in terms of Levy densities that I call monotone. And basically, the idea here is to try and put on the hypothesis that large jumps occur less frequently than small jumps, and so you want to have a decreasing structure to the arrival rates. And so here we just did a regression of log arrival rates that we got from our 100 years of data onto the size and jump size, onto the size and log size. And if you use like a Gaussian model for the distribution of the jump size, then you're saying that the arrival rates are linear in size and the square of the size. Whereas if you use like the log gamma model that we'll be looking at, then the arrival rates are linear in size and log size. And just to compare, so this structure is not completely monotone. I'll explain later how that is and why that is not completely monotone. And this structure is completely monotone. And we basically just did a simple regression of these log arrival rates on size and log size to see that basically the size-log size model gives you much better fit to the arrival rate structure than the size and size squared model. This model, as I said, not being completely monotone, that being completely monotone, and I'll argue later for why I think we should look at completely monotone structures. So much from looking at the data from an empirical broad brush viewpoint to see what the structure of local Gaussian models is. But now I want to also draw your attention to the theoretical case for why one wants to look at models that are different from the local Gaussian structure. And here I'd like to draw your attention first to the implications of no arbitrage. Basically, the models that we work with have the property that there's no arbitrage in the prices we quote. Now, I don't mean to say that there's no arbitrage in the economy. We hope there's arbitrage in the economy, and we find it and use it and make money from it. That's a good thing. But the point is that I don't want to put up prices on a screen where counterparties can electronically trade with me on all my strikes and all my maturities and rip me off. So I certainly want, when I'm quoting prices, to be quoting from a model that is free of arbitrage. So that tells us that discounted prices must be martingales under a measure change. So there is a measure, basically there's an if and only if theorem regarding no arbitrage and martingales, that tells us that basically you have no arbitrage in your system if and only if discounted prices are martingales, which tells us by Gersanov's theorem that originally the price processes must have been semi-martingales. So typically, most models that we build and most models that we construct are in the class of semi-martingale models. Now, if we look further at some characterization results of semi-martingales, we have this nice characterization that goes back in particular to a paper by Itrell Monroe, who pointed out and showed that semi-martingales can essentially be represented as time-change Brownian motion. So you basically take Brownian motion and evaluate it at an increasing random process that's your candidate for the time change, and that's essentially going to give you all your semi-martingales. And in one sense, this is a nice way of looking at the problem, because you're basically saying the way we see it is, okay, you basically have normality. You have Gaussian structure, but you have normality and Gaussian structure not necessarily in calendar time. What's relevant to the economy doesn't necessarily have to be the ticking of the clock. It may well be what many traders say, some days are like a week, and some weeks are like an afternoon. Just depends upon what's been going on. And so it makes sense to have a random time change involved that is economically, some kind of economic measure of activity and time. And so we can contemplate this idea that we want to look at our price process as Brownian motion evaluated at a time change. And so we focus attention on what time change to use. Now, when you do that and focus attention on the time change, here's the interesting consequence. If the price process were to be continuous, then essentially, unless you work hard at the mixing the time change and the Brownian motion, essentially the price process will be continuous if the time change is continuous. You take a continuous time change, evaluate Brownian motion at a continuous time change, you get a continuous process. But if the time change is continuous, then the time change is essentially a stochastic integral with respect to Brownian motion. That essentially characterizes all the continuous processes. And if that's the case, then we must remember that the time change is an increasing process. We're not reversing time. And that means that there's no martingale component in your time change. So basically, your time change becomes locally deterministic. If you believe, however, that your time change is not locally deterministic, has a martingale component, there's a martingale component and uncertainty to what the level of economic activity over the next interval is going to be, then basically, if time change is related to local random economic activity, which has a martingale component, then the price process is going to be discontinuous, or it's going to have a discontinuous component in it. And so we say, okay, empirical reasons and these theoretical arguments suggest that we look at discontinuous processes for possible candidates to our models. So where do we go? Well, the first step, the way we looked at this problem, was basically the following. We basically said that we're looking for an alternative to Brownian motion, which is a continuous process. We see that we don't have local Gaussian behavior. We see that we may have to tolerate discontinuity and jumps coming through the time change. But let's, in the first instance, keep all the other properties of Brownian motion in the model. So let's basically consider, we can build in stochastic volatility and we can build in all kinds of other things around our alternative candidate. So let's basically consider as candidates infinitely divisible processes of independent increments. Those are all properties of Brownian motion. Let's keep that structure and look there. And of course, we understand that structure very well, because by the Levy-Kinchin theorem, we have a complete characterization of the log characteristic function for such processes. And I've written the log characteristic function in a special form here. You'll notice that I don't have the u squared term, because I've accepted the absence of a continuous Martingale component. I'm looking at only pure jump processes. And I don't have a second order term here. And that second order term comes in here only if this function k, which is the Levy density, which is basically evaluating the arrival rates of jumps of different sizes, doesn't integrate the absolute value of x in the neighborhood of 0. And so to get integrability, you need to put another term here and then adjust this coefficient accordingly. But if you deal with processes of finite variation, and you have this kind of condition holding, namely if you take the absolute value of the price changes and add them up, these are absolute values of price changes in log, and if you, I mean, typically, in my view, of course, I would think that the absolute value of price changes is a bounded random variable. It's never been outside the interval of plus or minus 20% in all history. I would say, it should be, even if there are lots of small changes, I mean, I would think that it would be additive. And so I say, let's, in the first instance, take finite variation processes. Of course, Brownian motion itself is infinite variation, and these kinds of integrals are infinite for Brownian motion. Let's take finite variation processes in the first instance, and so with this kind of property, we can write the log characteristic function in that form. Now, further, so that's the property of finite variation. The next property is the property of infinite activity. Basically, if you look at the price changes that one may be contemplating, we are dealing with high levels of financial transactions per day. We're dealing with thousands and thousands of transactions. And so it's a very high level of activity. Okay, it's not infinite. It is finite. But it's not 5, 10, 20. It's a large number. And so with that perspective in mind, I said, let's, in the first instance, see if basically the data is in support of infinite activity processes, where the total number of jumps in any interval is actually finite. And so the Levy density integrates to plus infinity, but it's not so finite that mod x doesn't integrate. So we're saying let mod x integrate, but the Levy density itself has an infinite integral. So that's the idea of infinite activity processes. And the next concept was this idea of completely monotone. And when you look at Gaussian structures can be approximated by basically tossing coins, just heads and tails, and you have local volatilities you measure. And it's really basically a locally linear world. When you go away from Gaussian structures to Levy densities, you're going from linear into nonlinear. And when you go into nonlinear, linear is something specific. Nonlinear is not something specific, is anything. And so if you don't put any structure, then identifying and understanding the world is going to get difficult for you. And so it's useful to approach such an environment with as much structure as you're willing to give it. And one piece of structure I'm willing to give it is to say that the arrival rates are related by size, namely that 3% moves occur less frequently than 2%, 2% less frequently than 1, and that there is a monotonicity in the structure of arrival rates. And I say that's a reasonable structure, so let's take that, but let's take that and make it, in fact, strict. So we say we'll take the Levy density to be completely monotone. Now, completely monotone is a mathematically strict way of saying monotone. What it means is that if you look at the Levy density just for the positive jumps, its derivative is negative, its second derivative is positive, its third derivative is negative, fourth is positive, fifth is negative. So you have alternating derivatives. And essentially, the idea of complete monotonicity is that you're dealing with the Laplace transform of a positive function, the positive half line. And so we basically take for our models, as a first cut and first instance, Levy densities that have properties like this. And all the models that we look at, basically this kind of property holds, and we can work out what the G function is for the Levy density on the plus and minus sides. Now, before I go into describing the structure of how we approach the data and ask these kinds of questions of the data, I want to say something about this issue of diversity of opinion and the Levy density. And basically, I said one of the things we want to learn and one of the things we need to learn, because, I mean, you know, you can price vanilla options and calibrate them to the market, because the market gives you lots of vanilla option prices and you can calibrate your model to it. But then you've got to go and price barriers and exotic options and knockouts and double knockouts and claims that basically you have, you don't get it unless it knocks in, but if it knocks in and then knocks out, then you don't get it again. I mean, so there are complicated claims like that. And when you go to price those, you can't calibrate them to data on the market. That's not there. And then you could say, well, okay, I'll just fit a model to the European option prices, and then I'll use that model to price these claims. Fine. I can show you models that will fit all option prices for all strikes and all maturities exactly. Two models that will fit the whole surface exactly, and one model will price the exotic at 10 cents, and the other one will price it at 80 cents. What are you going to do? Which one are you going to choose? And there are many models that will fit. See, because when you fit vanilla options, all you have is the marginal distributions. You don't have any joint density information, and there are many, many processes that will fit the marginal distributions exactly and give you widely different prices for the path-dependent options. And so, basically, if you put this up before a trader and you tell him to charge this price, charge 80 cents or charge 10 cents, you're going to say, why? What do you want me to do with the money? What am I going to do? You want me to charge 80 cents? What is the reason? Oh, because this thing fit these option prices? Come on, that's not a way to trade. And so, basically, you have to understand the P&L of the whole trade and what's happening. And you're going to do that under the statistical measure. And so under the statistical measure, you analyze the trade, and then you've got to basically see how the measure, how the market changes measure. Yeah.
But from what you described, it seems like the problem is that the market is incomplete because it can't replicate the other one. So in that case, you're in a difficult situation.
Yes. Oh, yes. You are in a difficult situation. You are in an incomplete markets context. You have to understand pricing in incomplete markets. You have to understand how markets price risk. So you have to look at what kinds of trades people are willing to pay to do and what they're willing to charge for various moves. And so what I'm saying is that what I want to do is to get a P measure and get a Q measure, both of which talk to each other in the same parametric class to begin with, say, and then take my parametric class to be large enough so that I can put both of them in there. And then I have half a chance of setting the dynamic in the world and seeing what kind of measure changes are appropriate. And if I learn from where I have information about what... See, I know that you put on this trade. I know you sold it for this much. I know what your P&L histogram was under the P measure on that trade. You come to me with an exotic. I don't just tell you to sell it for this price. I tell you, you take that money. I recommend for you a hedging strategy with that money. I recommend for you a full P&L, just like I showed you on the other trade. And then I say the reason for this price is I can re-engineer a P&L structure that you've already been sitting with on all the other trades. And so what I'm saying is that therefore we need to learn about the structure of measure changes in the analysis of hedged P&L. And to advocate whenever you make a price recommendation to a trader on a product, you make a hedge recommendation at the same time. And you make a P&L presentation at the same time. And in doing that, one thing that's important is you must have the Q measure, you must have the P measure, you must put them in a framework where you can understand the radon nicotine derivative. And most importantly, you shouldn't tie your hands. And By that I mean this property. It is desirable that we permit a diversity of views on the parameters of the process to coexist, especially in PNQ. Okay? I don't want to take structures that force the volatility under Q and P to be the same. I know from data they are not. I don't want to force them to be the same. And the other thing is, why are they the same? They are the same by Gersanov's theorem. Okay? What do we know about Gersanov's theorem? We know that it fails in every approximation to the process. And a theorem that fails in every approximation to a process should never be used by a practical man in a real trade. You don't rely on theorems that fail in approximations. So you must make sure that if you're using a theoretical argument, that that theoretical argument survives approximation. The structure is valid in the entire limiting process and not just a property of the limit. If something is just a property of the limit, as far as I'm concerned, it's out the door. I don't use models like that.
Gersanov's theorem certainly has its analogs in binomial tree models.
Yes, but you can change volatility there.
Consider those.
Yeah, but you can change volatility there. Every approximation, the binomial, you will change the vol. It doesn't. It's only in the limit that it doesn't change.
You're just talking about volatility.
Right, yeah, yeah. See, that's a parametric restriction that I mean, there are people who are estimating jointly the P&Q measure, and they are forcing the volatility to be the same across both because that's part of the theorem. And what I'm saying is if you do that, you're either going to get a lousy P or you're going to get a lousy Q, in which case I don't want to look at your DQDP. I'm not interested in your add-on nicotine derivative if your two measures are not decent. I must sign off on P and I must sign off on Q before I look at your add-on nicotine derivative. And I'm not going to sign off on them if you force that kind of constraint. I'll show you how I find the Q. Yeah, I'll show you how I find the Q. We do a lot of study of Q. So that's the point that I wanted to make. And basically for Levy processes, the radon nicotine derivatives, there's not much restrictions being placed. You can basically construct the radon nicotine derivative by the ratio of the two Levy densities. And you may have a few integrability problems, but for example, if you have two Levy densities, KQ and KP, one of the conditions you require for their equivalence is this condition, then Q and P are equivalent. Now, if P is finite variation, it integrates mod X. Q is finite variation, it integrates mod X. This thing is going to be finite. You've got no problems. There's no restrictions here. Okay? If you take infinite variation processes, like the process of independent stable increments, then the parameter that delivers infinite variation cannot be changed by measure change. It must be forced to be the same. And I'm wary of processes and structures where I am forced to keep parameters constant between Q and P. So now, let me get further into how we go about estimating Q and estimating P, constructing DQDP, and taking a look at these structures, and what kinds of questions we're asking the data in the process. So the questions that we were asking the data in this particular paper was questions like, does the churn process have a diffusion component? Basically, after I have put in there an infinite activity Levy structure that allows for infinitely many moves in any interval, do I still need to add on a diffusion? I know that in jump diffusion models, the diffusion component is very important, because there you're modeling small, large activity by the jump component, and you're modeling the infrequent large by the jump component, and you're modeling the high activity by an orthogonal diffusion component. And you need that. But once you have a jump component that has infinite activity, then you may be able to dispense with the diffusion component. And the other thing is that the Levy densities that we're looking with also have the nice property that they link large and small behavior by the property of complete monotonicity. Basically, you cannot increase the rate of large activity without simultaneously doing something about the small activity. So they are linked in a unified way, as opposed to approaching it by using two orthogonal processes to study the phenomena.
Question about the jump component. So whenever you have a jump, let's say it's divisible, underlying Poisson process, unless the jump size is a constant number, then basically you have to have
Oh, these markets are grossly incomplete. These markets require all options to complete markets. So we're learning. You see, in these models, the options are not derivative assets. They are market-completing assets, and their prices have information. And we wish to extract the information content of option prices. And we extract that information in terms of, as I'll show you, as to what the market charges for jumps of different size. There's a risk premium for every jump size, and that is what you extract from market prices.
Presumably, in the market, there are only 5% security trade in options or whatever you call it. But then, when you have a jump, normally you say the market is infinite and incomplete, meaning that you need infinite amount of number of securities to complete market.
Well, we're working in principle with the entire continuum of strikes and maturities.
Well,
and we will quote on any number you like.
Yeah.
You come to me on an arbitrary strike, whatever number you pick it, we'll quote on it. You won't find an investment asset won't quote. You'll give any maturity, any strike, we'll quote.
But the thing I worry is that given that you only have a finite number of securities, then
I'll show you. You see, in principle, lots of things are getting infinite. And you might say you won't be able to work it out, all right? And I agree you won't be able to work it out. For example, if I tell you that the Levy density is an arbitrary continuous function that's just completely monotone, and I want to identify the G function whose Laplace transform it is, that's infinitely many degrees of freedom, and I only have 200 options, okay? But when I finally go to the data, I'm going to the data with an 8-parameter model, a 7-parameter model, I'll be able to calibrate with 200 options easily. So I'm backing it out in a structure. So I don't really have infinitely many degrees of freedom over there because I'm saying that the Levy density is structured in a certain way. Within that parametric class, it's identified. It's not globally identified, but parametrically within a class it is. And that's how we're approaching the problem.
Well, the metric class problem is very hard. Now, you're imposing, the thing I want to get to is that if the market is incomplete, in general, you have multiple EMM, including multiple measures. Now you're assuming that I'm going to pick that one that has a class, which is sort of a deferred by the selection process.
Right.
One of those because
right.
Pin down the parameter. Is that what you're?
That's right. That's exactly what we're doing. Yeah, pinning them within a class, and then within that class, picking them by least squares. And so, among the other questions we ask is, well, can we tell from data whether the jump component is one of finite or infinite activity? Can we tell whether the data wants to look at processes with infinite variation or finite variation? And can we tell from data whether Levy densities are completely monotone? We can't tell everything about these things. These are complicated questions to ask of the data. And so what we do is take a stab at it in a parametric way. We basically parametrize these differences, estimate the parameter, and see what that is saying. So that's sort of our first cut at this kind of problem. So to answer these questions parametrically for the data, I'll begin with the model that we have been working with for a long time, which is this variance gamma model that I've been associated with its development over the last 10, 15 years, and we use it, these days it is used regularly at Morgan Stanley to mark the books. It's estimated every evening on all assets worldwide, all equity assets worldwide. I mean, Hong Kong, London, all the exchanges. So this model is obtained as follows. You basically take Brownian motion with drift theta and volatility sigma. So that would give you theta t plus sigma w of t. Now we say there's a time change, and there's a random time change, increasing random process that we're going to time change with. So the time change we use here is a pure jump process, an increasing pure jump process that is given by the process of independent gamma increments. Over non-overlapping intervals, you take a gamma process, build the gamma process, evaluate the Brownian motion with drift at gamma time. You pick up three parameters in the process. There is theta, which is the drift in the original Brownian motion, sigma, which is the wall of the Brownian motion. And then the gamma process typically will have two parameters, but as you can see, they'll confound with these. And so we basically picked the mean time to be time, and we just had a volatility of the gamma time. So the gamma process has a volatility given by nu, and the mean of the gamma process is t, and then this is a three-parameter process that is the variance gamma process. It has a very simple, nice, and neat closed form for its analytical characteristic function. The characteristic function is easily obtained by first conditioning on the gamma time and then integrating out, knowing the characteristic function of the gamma. And so this is basically the Gaussian thing then substituted into the gamma, and this gives you the characteristic function for the variance gamma. So it's a very nice, neat closed form for that characteristic function. Now, we want to learn more about this process. What kind of process is it? We know it's pure jump because it's Brownian motion at gamma time. Gamma's jump, so it's jump. So what kind of Levy-Kinchin decomposition does it have? What kind of Levy density does it have? So to figure that out, we basically recognize that we can write this process as the difference of two increasing processes, which establishes that it is finite variation and also teaches us what kind of process it is. And that's done in the following way. Basically right here, we want to write that as the difference of two increasing processes. It turns out that you can write it as the difference of two gamma processes. So there's a positive gamma process and a negative gamma process whose difference is the VG. And the way you see that is, again, fairly simple. You've got this object raised to a power t over nu. If you write that object this way, and when you raise it to the power t over nu, this will be the positive gamma. That's the gamma characteristic function. And this is the negative gamma, which is another gamma characteristic function. And so you basically solve this quadratic equation down here to write the variance gamma as a difference of two increasing processes. Yes?
Can you remind me in any other what the gamma process is?
The gamma process is built just like Brownian motion is built, where you want to specify the density over non-overlapping intervals. Okay, so the density over non-overlapping intervals for Wiener process is you take Gaussians and you add them up. So here you take gamma density. Gamma density is on the positive half line, and it's of the form g to the power t over nu, e to the minus g over nu. And so you use those densities to build the process up. And of course you do it just like you build Wiener measure. You build window sets and define the probabilities over that, and then use the Kolmogorov extension theorem to go to the whole space. But you know, that's how you construct the process. But it's independent gamma increments and other parameters. And the nice thing, just like Wiener process, has the property that the sum of normals is normal. So you have this here. The sum of gammas picked in a certain way is gamma within the same class. And so you have, so when you multiply a couple of these up, you know, you have additivity in T. You have additivity in T, and so that's what gives you the fact that the sum of gammas is gamma and keeps the process working. Infinite number of jumps in each time interval. And the Levy density, we know the Levy density of the gamma. So you've got a positive gamma, you've got a negative gamma, we know exactly the Levy density. And we basically work out then that that is the Levy density of the variance gamma model. It's basically negative exponential divided by x, or negative exponential divided by mod x on the plus and minus side. And it's the division by mod x that makes it infinite activity, because in the neighborhood of zero, the Levy density behaves like 1 over x, which integrates to plus infinity. So this is an infinite activity process. You can see that clearly. Of course, we already know it's a difference of two gammas, and so it's finite activity, finite variation. But you can also see that it's finite variation. If you multiply the Levy density by mod x, you just have an exponential, which is integrable. And so you know that you can integrate mod x against the Levy density, so it's finite variation. So it's a finite variation process, and you pick up these three parameters, C, G, M. Basically we note that theta is the skewness parameter. When theta is negative, G is less than M, and you get more left tail. When theta is positive, you get more right tail. So you can build up the different levels of skewness by changing the parameter theta. So theta gives you control over skewness. And the parameter nu basically gives you control over kurtosis. You can show simply that for zero theta, the excess skewness over 3 is 1 plus nu. So nu is precisely the excess percentage kurtosis over the Gaussian. And so it's a perfectly, you know, reasonable model. And calibrates to data very well. As I said, we've been using it now. It's been 3 years that we've been calibrating it every day worldwide. And I just give you some, that's a simple graph of its calibration. The circles are the market prices. The dot dash line is the model prices. And this is a calibration on July 1 to the standard S&P 500 index. Yeah.
Smile
through the theta.
The fatness of the tail through the process, and that's
right. Yeah, right. Yep, through the process. Through the process. Through the Levy density. You change the Levy density in the theta parameter, and that changes the structure of the process and gives you more skewness. And you'll see later on in the estimates how significant the risk-neutral skewness is. The value of G and M. If G equals M, or if theta equals zero, the Levy density is symmetric, and it's the same shape on both sides. Okay? Statistically, that's often the case. Often statistically, the positive tail can be higher, but you go to the risk-neutral data, a typical value for G is 10, a typical value for M is 40. Okay? So the
both sides are different.
Right? Different. Very different. Very different.
Can I actually try asking the question, Scott? Because I make my living trading some of these options. I don't make my living as a professor, but I have to make those living. Some of the days like today are not a good day for that particular type of living. Because I do a lot of selling of those outside options. So if you go to the Jackworth Rubenstein papers, where they look at the implied distributions from the real option prices after the crash, okay, they find very, very fat tails. And it's, I think, very consistent
right. Yes.
With what you're showing.
Right.
Now, I believe, Dilla, that the fatness of those tails is composed of several things. There's the real fatness because the real stochastic process is fat. Then there's the aspect of the fact that those options are bid up by people who are
exactly
in the market.
Right. Exactly right. So exactly right. I'll show you. I'll come back to this point.
My question is maybe for later. Is there some way to decompose the aspects of these prices into two or three components, which I really believe that there is? I don't know if your theory says that, if it's consistent with that. So that gets at my question. I'll stop there.
Yeah. Okay. I'll come back to it. Show you how it's decomposing. Between statistical and risk neutral, what I think is driving the risk neutral, what the economic theory tells you, how the data is not consistent with the economic theory, and what resolutions I'm offering, okay, in that. But so that's just a graph on the SPX. Here's a graph on the Nikkei. And you can let me pass on from here. And the model fits reasonably well, and we've been doing it for a long time. And I might point out in passing that we've been fitting the model separately for each maturity. Of course, a good model should fit all maturities simultaneously, and this is not that good a model. And no model, we show, no homogeneous Levy processes will fit the option prices across all strikes and maturities, none. The reason is very simple. You take the characteristic function of a homogeneous Levy process, its log is linear in time. Simple calculation then shows you that skewness will go down like the square root of 1 over t, kurtosis will go down like 1 over T. You go to the data, you can estimate the skewness and kurtosis, and they are rising. Okay? So no matter how many parameters you put into your Levy process, homogeneous Levy process, you will not fit the maturity spectrum. So you have to do something else there. We are doing something else there. I've developed models for that. We just finished a paper on it. I just finished last week, and we're approaching coding up and going into production with these later development models. But this paper was about the homogeneous Levy structures to begin with. Now, in asking these other questions about the model, about finite activity, infinite activity, and whatnot, we modified the Levy density with one simple parameter. We added a parameter y. Instead of looking at e to the minus x over x, as you have in the variance gamma, we took x to the 1 plus y mod x to the 1 plus y. This parameter y is an interesting parameter because of the work it does. Basically, if y is below minus 1, then this number is negative in the denominator, and so it comes up into the numerator, and you have a gamma form. Okay, and that means that you've got a density that is certainly finite activity. It'll integrate, no problem of integration. You know, a power multiplied by a negative exponential integrates, so it's finite activity. But it's also not completely monotone because it's going to go up and then down. So you've lost complete monotonicity and you've got finite activity. When y crosses minus 1 but is less than 0, then you have complete monotonicity. You can basically check that out using gamma density functions that you've got complete monotonicity. But you have finite activity. You lose finite activity when y gets to 0 and you come to the variance gamma case. The variance gamma case is where you enter infinite activity for the first time in this parametric representation. And so basically between 0 and 1, you have infinite activity and finite variation. You cross 1, you get to infinite variation. Okay? You cross 1, you get to infinite variation. And of course, we can take this model to the data, estimate the parameter y, and see what it's telling us. And to cut the story short, most of our estimates for y are between 0 and 1. And we have finite activity, infinite variation processes, both statistically and risk neutrally. For this function, the characteristic function is fairly easy to obtain. The log characteristic function is given by this expression. There's a bracket there. It's m minus iu, the whole thing to the y, minus m to the y, plus this. So the characteristic function is perfectly analytic. Now, to build the stock price model from this kind of process, we basically follow Black-Scholes and take the exponential for the characteristic function. And what I've got over here is, okay, I mean, I should have, this slide comes after the next one. They're kind of out of order, just a little. Basically here, we extend the CGMY process with a diffusion because we want to ask the question whether we need an additional diffusion component, so we add it. So CGMYE is CGMY plus eta W, which is a diffusion component, and its log characteristic function is pretty simple, straightforward, because these are two independent processes, so you take this guy and then you add the log of the Gaussian. Then to build stock price models, we follow Black-Scholes and take the exponential. And so we're taking the exponential of XCGMYE and then putting in the Jensen's inequality correction to basically divide by the expectation of that exponential to basically have this whole thing be a unit mean process and a unit mean martingale because it's an independent increment process and fix the mean rate of return to be mu. So you can basically get the mean rate of return to be mu. And, of course, when we go to option prices, we use interest rate for the mu, because we're having discounted prices, discounted by the interest rate B martingales. And so we can get the log characteristic function very straightforwardly for this model. Now, I want to say one word about how we estimate Q and what the technology is for Q. We feel, a great technology for estimating Q, and we've been doing it for a variety of models. I have about 10, 15 models that I calibrate very quickly to the whole option surface using this technology. And this comes from a paper that Peter Carr and I wrote for the Journal of Computational Finance in 1999. And it's based on the fast Fourier transform and the following approach. You think of the call price as a function of the log of the strike. So when log strike goes to infinity, call price goes to zero, fine, no problem. When log strike goes to minus infinity, call price will go to the spot price. And this function is not L2. So make it L2 by dampening it. Multiply by e to the alpha k for positive alpha that sits the left side down. And the right side is going down because of C of k. And you can basically show that as long as the alpha moment of the stock price exists, it goes down on both sides. And so we take this function as an L2 function and compute its Fourier transform. So you compute the Fourier transform in log strike. Compute the Fourier transform in log strike of this object that we call the modified call price. That Fourier transform is completely analytic in the log characteristic function. Give me the log characteristic function. Give me a model where you know the characteristic function of the log of the stock. Then you know gamma immediately. So one application of the FFT, and you got your call prices. One application of the fast Fourier transform, you got your call prices. And what's beautiful is that the FFT works on matrix objects just as well as it works on vectors. And so you apply it to all maturities simultaneously. And so within seconds, you have option prices for all strikes and all maturities that can go into nonlinear least squares calibration algorithms. So your option pricing computation is fast enough for you to go into calibrating the whole surface. I mean, in this model here, in this paper here, we were calibrating one maturity. But today, these days, I'm calibrating the full surface because I'm working with models that go across maturity as well. Yeah. Yeah.
For the S&P. We had 4 days of very calm S&P. Volatility dropped all the way down to like 20. Nothing was happening for 4 days. Nothing. And the volatility comes down. And we have the volatility curve coming up pretty steep still, but not.
Yeah, I agree, Bill.
Today, we have a lot of.
Bill. I mean.
Shows hitting the market. It gets much, much steeper up here, plus the overall volatility goes way, way up. How does the model capture that?
Yeah, well, we can get into a discussion on this. But I'll tell you. You see, for one thing is...
Do you have a parameter to capture that somehow?
Well, the way the models are used is for marking books at market close. It's very estimated every evening,
right.
And no trader is asking me for today's model to work tomorrow. And nobody's even looking at that. And I'm not looking at it. Okay? Now, if I were to do an exercise on the time series structure of these models...
Yesterday's close?
Yeah, no, but if I was to do that, I would recognize that this one-dimensional Markovian context is not rich enough, in my view, to explain the time series evolution of option price surface.
Okay.
And what you need to then do is to take the parameters that are being estimated on a stable basis and look at what is the higher dimensional Markovian-Martingale representation of that filtration. Where?
So your parameters would be constant across yesterday and today.
My parameters would then become the part of the process.
Right.
And you would then be looking at...
At
the moment, I'm not doing that.
They're constant between yesterday and today.
No, they're not. They estimate it every day.
What changed today versus yesterday? The change in the parameter values.
The markets move.
You're using
the skewness moves.
You're using the market prices to re-estimate the parameters.
All right, yeah. That's right, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Will that give you a steeper smile? You're then re-estimating the steeper smile.
Yeah. Because all they really want is to mark the relatively illiquid OTC options relative to the liquid market ones. And so...
So you can price the theoretical values better.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's so far what the exercise is. And I believe that the overtime structure, it's very interesting, this overtime structure, because nobody really knows. I mean, I don't really believe that a one-dimensional Markovian context is the context of the evolution dynamically of the option pricing surface. I believe it's a higher dimensional object, but this is a way of getting there.
So just sort of to Bill's question, now that if you're not thinking about the
you see, so I say the following. My ultimate objective would be to have a model that does a good job of explaining option prices for all strikes, for all maturities, and does this continuously through time without changing parameters. Okay? That would be an ultimate objective. Now, to get there, I say there are three dimensions here. K, strike, cap T, maturity, little t, calendar time. My ordering is this. First, get me a model that works on K. Okay? Among the classes of models that work on K, look at models that work across cap T. We have the greatest structure in K. In K, we have convexity of option price with respect to K. A lot of structure in K. If you've got any chance of doing anything, you should succeed on K first. After you've got K, we know something about maturity. We know that there's positive forward variance. We know that there's calendar spread arbitrage. We know that there are certain things there. So let's do cap T. Now, among the models that are successfully doing K and cap T, okay, we then look at what we can do in terms of getting stability over little t. So that's the way in which I've organized the hierarchy of my research agenda on this. And at the moment, I'm just beginning to conquer K and cap T. I haven't even started looking at little t, and I won't yet, because I still got to get enough experience over cap T. I'm only just beginning to develop models that work across K and cap T, and I've got to get a good feeling of those before I can approach the question of what's happening over little t. So that's how, you know, I've structured my work on this. Now, in terms of looking at the results that we get, there are many issues and matters of interest. One can, of course, look at statistical moments and look at what the skew and kurtosis is, risk neutrally and statistically. One can decompose quadratic variation and see how much comes from the continuous martingale component, how much is coming from the jump component. These are interesting things about the data, statistically and risk neutrally. But the most interesting thing to look at from my point of view and what I wish to understand is to understand the explicit measure change. That is, you take the statistical parameters, you estimate them in some parametric class, whichever one you like. This one here is CGMY. You go to the options data. So you go to the time series data to get these guys. You go to the time series data, maximum likelihood estimation, get these parameters. You then go to the options data and construct the risk-neutral representation. Now, when you've done this, you've got Q and P in the same parametric class. And you can construct the radon nicodeme derivative. The radon nicodeme derivative is given by the ratio of the two Levy densities. Basically, it's a stochastic exponential of y minus 1. This is a stochastic exponential. Yeah.
I think I forgot the answer in the last slide, but there are lots of Q possible.
Yes. Right. But parametrically...
Speaking about the Q.
Right. You see, I've got a parametric structure, right? Within that parametric structure, I've got maybe four parameters, five parameters, say. I go to market close, okay? I have 200 option prices, about 20 option prices at 10 maturities. Okay? I do nonlinear least squares within this parametric class.
So you get a class of all possible measures that give you a possible Q, and then you will fit.
Then I fit the data. Okay? And then when I fit the data, okay, if the model, and I have models that are fitting the data, and the average percentage error is 8%, okay, that's not acceptable to the trading floor. I can't use such a model, so I say this model is out. I must get down to between 2 and 3% before I'll do any work with it. Okay.
If you have, let's see, if one believes the theory of martingales, then each martingale gives you a possible price, and there's a limit. And obviously, you'll choose all your martingales from this model.
Right.
So can you choose upper and lower bounds for interesting exotic options from your model? Upper and lower bounds so bad that they're not useful?
Yeah, you can take these structures and then simulate and price exotics, and we have begun to do that. Okay. But as I was pointing out earlier, the price variations in the exotics are quite significant. Like you can take a local volatility model and price an up and out call at around 16 cents, and then you take a pure jump, one of these models, they're giving 80 cents. Okay, so the difference is a lot. And so basically at this point today, we're basically saying nobody knows how to price exotics.
No, but you can say that nobody in their right mind would charge less than this, and nobody in their right mind would pay more than that, if you could calculate it all.
Yeah, I guess for that you would need to formalize the theory of the space in which you've done your search and prove that you've got a max and min. We haven't quite done that. We've just taken examples, okay? So I can't say that it can't go below this and it can't go above that. But my hope is that I'm going to not calibrate and price an exotic and tell a trader, sell for this or buy for this, because like I've been saying, I have to answer the question, what do you want me to do with the money, okay? So if you sell for this, you get this money, what do you want to do with it, okay? And what you want to do with it is put on some kind of hedge or some kind of P&L alternator, something that alters the P&L from what you've just taken on to something that you're going to like, okay? And so what I'm saying is that you've got to basically identify statistical measures and identify hedge structures and then look at the P&L before you can recommend on exotics. So at the moment I'm saying that our understanding of exotics is not, you know, all that great. But here you can construct this Levy density. I mean, you can construct the Y process. You can construct the radon nicotine derivative explicitly, see what it looks like, and basically it's telling you Y of X is the market price for a jump of size X. What is Y of X?
Y was your parameter.
Oh, sorry, that bad notation. I mean, this is a function. I'm stuck with Yakov and Shireyev's notation for the radon nicotine derivative. Okay, so that was a parameter. Here's a function. Sorry about that. Yeah. And this is the explicit construction of the radon nicotine derivative. And this is the explicit representation of Y, and we'll see graphs of it later, and I'll show you how we're interpreting them. Now, in the interest of time, let me quickly go through the results. We basically estimate the statistical process by maximum likelihood. And this is an estimate of the statistical process and a whole lot of underlyings. The underlyings are given there, Boeing, GE, Hewlett-Packard, IBM, Intel. And then down here you have the indexes, BIX, BKX, DRG, Russell 2000, SPX. You have the indexes. And basically we see that the diffusion components are near absent in the indexes. You find them somewhat in a couple of single names. The parameter Y is typically between 0 and 1. Okay, there may be some cases where it's above 1, some cases where it's negative. Never less than minus 1, so you certainly have a complete monotonicity, and otherwise mostly between 0 and 1. If you look for the skewness parameter, the theta is many times positive, okay? Sometimes it's negative in the indexes, but many times positive, so there's no real solid indication of a negative skew in the statistical process. And this is the representation in terms of the CGM processes. If you look at a graph of the densities, a typical shape of the densities is the absence, especially on the indexes, is the absence of a bell curve. You basically have the densities coming like a pencil point, okay? And, of course, that's coming from the Levy process and a double negative exponential structure of the Levy process. And so you have these pencil point densities for the statistical process as opposed to a bell curve. So you can basically draw histograms of your data and basically just tell. If it's looking like a pencil point, you know it's pure jump process without a Gaussian component.
Can you help some of us with a little more on the interpretation of the four parameters and how they affect the shape a little bit?
I mentioned that the three parameters, the theta gives you the skewness, the nu gives you the kurtosis, The sigma is the basic wall. The y parameter is a little hard. I've not thought about how to relate it to the moments as such. Okay, but it's really characterizing process properties, finite variation, finite activity, infinite variation. That's what it's doing, okay? And so we're observing that y lies between 0 and 1, which is infinite activity, finite variation. We're observing risk neutral, statistically not much Q, okay, maybe positive sometimes. But go to the risk neutral data, go to the options, okay?
Can I ask you this further question?
Yeah.
Back to today. Today we have the sharp move up. Okay, which parameter is capturing the sharp move up in the smile? Which I presume is.
Well, you see, you've got to see that when you're looking at
you recalibrated at the end of today's happened. You've now recalibrated it for each day. What parameter?
Well, yeah, but Bill, I mean. When you calibrate today, you only calibrate risk neutral. You never fit time series data with one day. Well, I never have. Okay? Time series data is over 5 years. Which curve? That is risk neutral. That is not this table I showed you. Okay? The table I'm... risk neutral is the following table. That's fitting the option prices. At one point of time, market close. Doesn't matter what happened during the day because option prices are fitting how the market prices assets at a fixed point of time. Okay? There is no time series in it at all. Right? And there you have these kinds of parameters, and you should notice that you have very, very strong skews. The theta parameter is negative. The G and M differ like crazy. Look at the difference. That is how fast the positive tail comes down. This is how fast the negative tail comes down.
What happened yesterday versus what happened today? We have yesterday's tail.
Yeah, I could look at it, but I mean, I've not looked at that, no.
You feel you can say much about that?
Not right now, no, I have to look at it and see. I mean, I could look at it and see, but I mean, you know.
Future research.
Right, yeah. So the skews are very different. Now, in the last couple of minutes, let me close with the measure change, okay? And the resolutions of the measure change. So this is a typical graph of the measure change on the S&P 500 index. This is DQDP, okay? This is DQDP. Every day I go, every time I go to the markets, a lot of times, and I estimate Q, I estimate P, I estimate DQDP, I draw a graph of it, I get this U-shaped picture. Now let me tell you the quandary and the resolutions of this picture. Basically, the Levy densities are limits of probability densities, so the Levy density is. So we can think of the ratio of Levy densities as the ratio of probability densities. So we can think of the risk-neutral probability density divided by the statistical probability density. Economic theory says that the objective probability density is PO, fine, is the objective probability density. That's the P. Economic theory says that the Q is the market price of risks of different size. How much are you willing to pay today for a dollar if the jump was X? If the market moves 2%, how much are you willing to pay for that today? And if it goes down 2%, how much are you willing to pay for that today? That is given in economic theory by the ratio of marginal utility tomorrow to marginal utility today. You divide marginal utility by marginal utility today, you get the rate of transformation between money to state contingent money and current money. So that is, tomorrow, my marginal utility depends upon my position. So I'm holding some cash flow, some I might be holding a portfolio of options. So this is my position. C of S minus E to the X is my position. That's my subjective probability. That's my marginal utility. This is marginal utility tomorrow, marginal utility today. That is Q. This is P. So y of x from economic theory should be of this form. Now, let's add some of the standard assumptions that come from economic theory onto that representation. First, we impose rational expectations. So rational expectation says subjective and objective probability are the same, so those terms cancel. Let's then suppose that we have a Lucas representative agent who's holding the stock. So C of S is just S. So if that's the case, and you take simple power utility, then you apply power utility to that, and you'll get, there's no difference between subjective and objective probability, and the ratio of marginal utility is going to be negative exponential. So this is a very popular measure change that is used in many papers and many studies. It's called the Escher transform in the mathematics literature or in the insurance literature, and it's called a power utility, a constant relative risk aversion utility function in the economics literature. And it's been used by many people to analyze measure changes in pure jump contexts in the study. I've used it myself, to study option pricing in these kinds of jump contexts. Okay, but this y of x is a decreasing function of x with no room for the increase observed with respect to positive values of x. I showed you a U-shaped measure change, and what's the other guy doing? A negative exponential does not come up. Okay, and so what are the resolutions of this? Well, I'll give you three resolutions of it and tell you which one I tend to support. One is failure of rational expectations. And there are a number of authors, Jay Schenken, from what I know, is also looking at this, of failure of rational expectations in the following form. We basically take the view that you know everything and you've learned everything about the stock price process except the mean. You don't know the mean. Nobody knows how to estimate the mean. It's too hard. So the economic agent has to mix over the mean. And if the subjective distribution is mixing over the mean, it's got wider spread than the objective distribution that knows the mean. And so the ratio will give you the two tails, will give you the ratio will give you the wings, the upward U shape. That's one resolution, maybe plausible. But what I'm thinking and lean more in favor of is what Bill was saying earlier as to what's going on in these markets. I say that there are heterogeneous beliefs, okay? We don't have homogeneity of beliefs. And I say that subjective probabilities are closest to objective probabilities for the delta-hedged option writers who are basically selling these options and monitoring the process and monitoring the hedge. And so I'm saying that if I say PS, subjective probability equals objective probability, that's true for somebody that's an option writer. His position is not long the stock. His position is a delta-hedged option right. If you look at the cash flow of a delta-hedged option right, basically we know that a delta-hedged option right loses money if there's big moves either side. If the market goes up, you lose. The market goes down, you lose. So if you apply marginal utility to the position of a delta-hedged option writer, you'll get the U-shape again. Okay? So the U-shape can come from there. This is the explanation that I think, and this is basically showing how, and this also basically shows that the kind of measure change you will see from day to day is going to depend very much upon the structure of inventory of option rights in the market. So for example, if I've written loads and loads of calls and no puts, and you come and you want to buy a put, I don't have to charge much of a premium on that. Okay, there'll be hardly any premium. But if you want to come and buy a call, I'm hurting already. Okay? So there's going to be a big premium on the call, right? And so the inventory of... So I'm thinking of not the Lucas representative agent that's holding the stock, but the Lucas representative option writer. Okay? The Lucas representative... So I'm taking all the option rights in the world, and I'm saying there's this one guy, Lucas representative option writer, he's holding all of them. He's written the whole lot of them. Okay? There's only one utility function that's writing options. And this is one guy has written them all, and then he's looking at the inventory and then working out the price structure from there. Okay? And I'm saying if you apply marginal utility to the delta hedge option right, you'll get the kind of functions I'm seeing. Now, another resolution is to also say that the measure change reflects the weighted individual personalized state price densities, namely, you know, it's like politicians. So when you took at the Lucas representative agent who's long the stock, that's one guy, he's long the stock, and his margin of security is downward like this. Now you look at the guy who's short, okay, the stock. There's some people that are short the stock. You look at their margin of security, it's going the other way, okay? You take a weighted average of those two, you got a U-shape. Now, why would you take a weighted average of those two? It seems reasonable. Basically, when somebody gets hurt, they scream, okay? And when something good happens to people, they just walk away casually in the sun and say, nothing, no real problem, okay? And so the markets respond to the screamers, okay? And basically, the short guys are screaming when the market goes up. The long guys are screaming when the market goes down. You give some weighting to the screamers, you pick up the U-shape, okay? And so you get the U-shape from that kind of picture. So there's three types of different ways of looking at the results, but the empirical results are in the direction of a U-shaped measure change. And so what I'm saying is that now if we go to the data and just force on it some economic theory that says utility functions are decreasing and we're just going to take Lucas representative agent rational expectation, force the utility function to go this way, and then force the option prices to eat that measure change, okay, you're going to do a lousy job on explaining option prices. And then your Q is not going to be, you know, worth it, because basically I'm saying, you know, my Qs have to pass certain tests. The prices, you have to come in to within a certain percentage of market price, otherwise not worth looking at the Q measure you got. Okay? And basically putting in a lot of exogenous constraints from this theory or that theory or that theory can mess you up, especially when you're just making a first cut at the data. So I'm saying at the first cut at the data, go as cleanly as possible. Estimate Q robustly. Estimate P robustly. Look at DQDP. See what the market is trying to teach you. And there are reasons. You can see that there are perfectly good reasons for it to be U-shaped. It doesn't have to be decreasing downward. And yet all the theoretical literature just takes decreasing downward functions. So that's the story. That's, I'll close with that. Yeah.
What is the tail of the distributions that you get from your process? The Gaussian would go down like e to the minus x squared, probability that's greater than x. How fast does this go down?
So these have excess kurtosis relative to Gaussian. And I know that if you look at the implied volatilities, I think that my guess is they're going down like not e to the minus x squared as Gaussian, please, but like e to the minus x.
Please don't explain it by implied volatility.
No, okay, okay. No. Yeah, okay. Now I'm just thinking, but I think my picture is, you know, I look at the Levy density like a limit of a probability density, okay, and that's going down like negative exponential instead of negative exponential squared. So I'd say the tail is more like e to the minus x rather than e to the minus x squared, okay? But it is faster than power laws, okay? And that basically is what gives me moments of all orders. So the processes I'm working with have moments of all orders. I'm not losing moments at any level in the log. I lose moments in the spa because that's the exponential, but I don't lose moments in the log. I have all moments in the log, whereas those power laws, of course, lose moments in the log.
Tails probably wouldn't be too much.
Yeah.
Because your time change is independent of the ground motion.
Right. Yeah.
So you talked a lot about construction of this pricing measure. I was just wondering if you could say something about how you would then go about constructing a hedging strategy. You price, use these options to determine your measure, found a price of another OPC option. How are you going to then prescribe a strategy to go along with that?
Yeah. I've been speaking loosely about that in terms of analyzing the P&L and basically trying to make a decision on whether the resulting P&L is going to be an acceptable position to take. Okay. Now, I have a paper that is forthcoming in the Journal of Financial Economics on pricing and hedging in incomplete markets where I take a cut at this, where I say that basically I take the view that if an arbitrage, which is getting non-negative cash flow at zero cost, is the only thing that you will do, then you won't go home tonight because there's a lot of risk of getting run over by a bus as you walk out. And we all take all kinds of risks every day. And we don't say that the only deals that we will do are non-negative for us in all states, okay? And so I'm saying is that we need to refine the concept of no arbitrage and to formally define the class of acceptable opportunities. And what we do in that paper is to define a cone that is bigger than the positive orthant, okay, but formalize the cone that we're going to allow ourselves to take. And now what I say is that when I put on a deal, I'm thinking of possibly having to unload it, okay? And I may have to unload it to Bill, I may have to unload it to you, I may have to unload it to Ulrich, all kinds of people. So I say, well, who are these counterparties? What kinds of positions are they in, okay? So if I look at a particular deal and I say, if I wanted to offload it to a short position, they'd take it. I wanted to offload it to a long gamma, they'd take it. I wanted to offload it to a long vega, they'd take it. A short vega, they'd take it. All of these guys would take it. Then I'd say, well, maybe we can do it. Okay? And so basically, I define a set of linear functionals on the space of cash flows that become my test measures, and then I test a deal against them, and if it passes, I recommend it.
Is that work with Peter Carr also?
Yes, that's work with Peter Carr and Helge Gemann, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so that's the direction we're kind of looking at going. But these are hard questions, I agree, and there's no clear-cut, you know, no a really smooth answer to them. But
so I think getting into the players in the market is really important because that has so much to do with the what's really going on. So I think that's messy, but that has so much to do with the inventory balances.
Yeah, I agree. I mean,
can I go back to one?
Yeah, sure.
You're almost done.
I'm done. Yeah.
Yeah. So I go back to my tale. Now, first of all, I don't want to really have the risk-neutral density, and I know that Chris Rogers. I gave a talk to Chris Rogers in the spring, and he showed me a paper he did with Satchel. I don't know where it's published or where it's going to be published or something.
Okay.
But what they showed basically is if you're trying to go from risk neutrals to regular probability.
Go back the other way.
To go from risk neutrals.
To statistical.
To statistical.
Yeah, it wants to go.
You have a lot of problems that they basically could fit almost anything in their paper. Okay.
Right, okay.
Which I think is known by people.
It is. I mean, there's a lot of variation in risk premium, and that's basically what that's saying.
Given that, and the fact that you can estimate the curve pretty well, and day by day you get your different estimates of your four parameters,
right?
Which you were supposed to have told the audience corresponds to the four authors. I don't know if everyone picked it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The CGM and Y were the four authors.
Now,
yeah.
Let's go back to something that I'm interested in. I look at the tails, and these tails are identical to my horse racing system that was in the Harsh Zimba Rubinstein 1981.
Right.
Where we look at horses with these tails, and then the smile is a similar kind of thing. Now, if we look at what causes the smile to be so high,
yeah.
Are these implied? The real implieds.
What do you mean by the real implied? They are the prices of the deals. They are not the likelihood of the deals. They are not the likelihood.
They're on very thin markets. So it's like when you get out there and look at these tails, okay, they're very, very thin in terms of the thing. So that the implieds that you get from formulas like...
Okay, all right. So then...
From other formulas.
Right, I agree. Okay. So then I'd say fine.
So there's a trend.
I'd say okay. So there's a thin market, and on that thin market, there's a number coming out, and you are off the view, or I could be off the view, that this is too high. Okay.
Yeah.
And I may want to come into that market at a different price.
I believe that the implied you get in those tails.
Yeah.
Are too high.
Okay. I agree. Agree. Okay. I agree. But then, I have to come up with say you're my trader and I'm doing this, and I then have to come up with. A, telling you, okay, let's go on this with a lower price, okay?
Yeah.
And now I got to show you what is the hedge I'm going to use that money with, okay? And what's the P&L I'm going to generate that you and I have agreed falls within our formulation of acceptable yields.
Now, let me look at that tail. Let me look at that tail and compare it to an option close to the money. Okay. Now, what makes that implied volatility way in the tail higher? There's a couple things, right?
Right.
Risk in the market. There's the fact that option players can buy these things for protection.
Right.
Overpay.
Right. Yeah.
Now, let's look at it from the point of view of the seller of these options. Okay. The seller of these options. Now, if we go to the Rubenstein-Jackworth paper, the seller of the option is getting a price that's because the market really thinks that the probability of an extreme event is very large.
No.
That's what they have in their
No, it may well be that the probability is small, but they are hurt a lot, and they're willing to pay for that.
That's true. That's right. That's true. But they also get the fact that the probability...
You can't infer the probability directly from there.
Yeah.
You can't. Yeah. I mean, that's the issue. There is a risk premium that's sitting in the middle, and it is volatile depending upon the endowment positions that people are in. And at some points of time, a seller will have to charge a big premium because he's already hurting in his book.
Absolutely.
Okay? And then another time, his book is thin there, and he says, okay, I'll do it for a premium of a penny.
Let me stop there.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Let's wind up here. And thanks very much.